And now,
from the didgeridoo to 140 miles east of Kalamazoo, at least as far as Google Maps says, this version is a tribute to Motown.
Your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour with Dean Haglund and Phil Lairness.
This is Phil Lairness in Los Angeles and over in the Motor City, freshly back from his East Coast jaunt. It's Dean Haglund. How are you, Dean?
Hey, everybody. Fantastic. How are you? More to the point.
Well, you know what? I'm feeling old today. And one of the reasons that I'm feeling old is looking at the old news feed and, you know, 5 shot in a synagogue in Poway, San Diego, 8 shot, 7 dead in, I think it's Sumnerville, Tennessee, 8 shot, 1 dead in a street picnic outside a Baptist church in Baltimore. That's one day in America. And I don't know why, but it just makes me feel old.
Old? Like, you lived it all? That's it? You done?
I can't muster the righteous indignation about it anymore. It's just a wound that I will carry with me that will accompany me however long I have left, I think, where we do nothing about this, nothing changes, this particular story of America, and of course this is where I think about it, and one of the reasons that it makes me probably feel old is I just think about, again, how much gun as problem solver, as plot resolution device.
Right. And as an emotional extension.
Was a part of our popular storytelling in this country for more than a century.
For more than a century. I mean, think of one of the early silent films as just a gun turning and pointing towards the audience and being fired, and everyone in the theater would duck because that's how we experienced two-dimensional images in black and white when we first saw it for the first time.
So, I don't know. I've got nothing. I've got nothing, no wisdom at all in this. But I will say I've been writing the narration for part of Truth Is Out There, The Truth Is Still Out There, part two of The Truth Is Out There.
Uh-huh.
That is about, you know, the stories, the mythology of America, the stories we tell, and maybe what some alternate stories are maybe more nourishing for us. And they are vis-a-vis the Old West, you know, because I see them in towns and I see them in neighboring towns, right? Towns whose whole reason to exist at this point is to simply keep perpetuating certain Western myths, and then towns near them that may be thriving because they've found whole new kinds of stories to remember and redeem.
Look at that.
So
that's optimistic, isn't it?
Well, I hope, but it really is fascinating that I'm writing this, you know, and writing it by hand because I'm having some eye problems.
are you?
On the same weekend that, you know, all this stuff comes down. But again, what weekend in America doesn't seem to involve a shooting?
Gunfire. Yeah. Right. Yes. That's a thing.
It's what we do. It's how we celebrate the weekends. I have nothing. I don't even want to get into the details of any of these at this point. Right. But I do want to hear about your journey to Rhode Island. You had never been to Rhode Island before.
Never been.
Providence is a really interesting city, I think. I think it's interesting culturally. I think it's interesting architecturally. The geography, the layout with the river, it's a fascinating, fascinating place. And you you attended a convention nearby there in neighboring Warwick.
Right. Which is just an extension, a suburban outpost.
I mean, where you were, unless I'm mistaken, is like literally across the street from the Providence Airport.
Yes, that's exactly right. I could see planes landing almost from my hotel room window.
Well, there you go. So how was it? How was your trip to Rhode Island? How was X-Filers United? I'm sorry to have missed it.
There seemed to be a little problem. Do you remember you and I when we traveled to Vancouver and we had rented out the Rio Theater and we were going to show the truth out there and do comedy improv? And we had set up with brown paper tickets.
So this is a beautiful theater, beautiful single screen theater with a stage. Yep. So I'm betting this is one of those wonderful picture palaces that was built probably during vaudeville, maybe?
Yeah, maybe.
And favorite son, Dean Haglund, returning.
yeah.
It was American Thanksgiving. And we found out... maybe a week before that?
I think 3 days before, maybe.
Well, but what I mean is we found out more than a week before that it was sold out. And we were gratified by that. And we'd gotten some press there and everything. And indeed, our screening in Seattle prior to that would sell out. So we were on a roll. And then we find out like 3 days before... Oh, yeah, no, that was a mistake. Brown paper tickets shut down because we checked with the theater, I think it was, or something. But somehow we found out that, they just had arbitrarily stopped selling tickets and showed it as sold out. So, in fact, rather than a sold-out house, however many people were going to the ticket site, they were getting turned away for a house that had sold maybe 20 to 30 tickets.
Right. So, in fact... the only people that came were those who just thought off chance that they could get a ticket just at the door.
Yeah, those people who either, who either really were very early in ordering tickets, or those people who expressed to us, oh man, I wanted to come, but it's sold out, who then we were able to get back to and say, no, it turns out it's not. Or anybody who just thought, well, I'll just take a try. And so you're I'm getting very warm now thinking about this. I'm remembering that and it was just so sad.
Yeah. So this kind of happened again, but in a convention form. So the tickets, you could buy the 3-day ticket. And of course, that started Friday. So then they close an hour before the show. So they closed all the tickets, not just the Saturday So the 3-day ticket you could get, the Saturday ticket only, the Sunday ticket only, they just shut all of that. So there was no way for anybody online to buy tickets for this thing. So to say it was poorly attended is kind of the thing that happened, unfortunately. But those who did attend, very committed to being there. So that's the good news.
Well, because they were the people who had bought the 3-day tickets.
Yeah, and then there were also the speakers. There was more speakers than attendees. And then there were some who were just supporting their friends who were speaking, who also, the Allagash Four, perhaps you remember them. They were
Wasn't that one of the beers we selected for my wedding, the Allagash Four?
Allagash White, actually.
Oh, okay.
We selected. Right, yeah. I'm sorry. The Allagash Four were four canoers that were an induction experience in 1976, and they came to hang out. They're all artists, as a matter of fact. So we had a great time talking about art and the art books. My Broadway walking tour books were big sellers. the paranormal convention.
Well, without you being there for the Allagash Four, I fear that X-Filers United would have been a more lonely experience for them than even being abducted.
Yeah, very much so. But I did buy, I got you a post-surgery gift in the form of two books, which would be great for your newly renewed vision.
Yeah, I mean, I really have not been able to read in almost a year, read a book in almost a year. That's how bad my eyesight has been since then.
Right.
Did you get a chance to explore any of Providence? See any of
it? I did. One of the reporters, turns out we performed together in an improv jam in Edinburgh 2008, believe it or not. With the Improverts. He was a member of the Improverts when he was studying Native American studies, was his major at the Edinburgh University. But he also then jumped with the Improverts, and we sort of kind of concluded that we perhaps were on stage together having a laugh some 11 years ago. So from that, he said, hey, come on, you got to see this town. And we went out to some restaurants, some fantastic places, historic building from the 1860s that was a delicious restaurant. You know, drove around, caught some, ate some lobster, the whole nine yards.
Well, I was disappointed about not getting to see Providence. I'd been there before, showed Carl Rove, I Love You, at the Rhode Island International Film Festival. We won an award there. And in fact, it was the best of times, it was the worst of times, because that was the festival where, after showing the film and going to festivals around the country and the world for, I guess, maybe 9 months at that point, because it was August and we'd started in November the year before. So, I mean, I was told there'd be no math, but 9 or 10 months, I realized, okay, I'm done. I was just burnt out. I was just burnt out.
Yeah.
And even though it was a great screening. And in fact, I'll never forget, I came back after the screening to the green room and at the headquarters, the festival headquarters, and everybody asked me, oh, what happened? What went wrong? And I said, oh, no, it was a great screening. Well, then why do you look morose? And I just realized, yeah, I'm exhausted. I can't do it anymore. And it just, you know, and you don't want people to feel that. You don't want you don't want people to see that. And it was just exhaustion. That was just all that they were seeing. True exhaustion. But the screening was fun. A native son of Providence, great actor, a dear old friend of Dan Butler, who would that year be nominated for Best Actor in a Motion Picture, Richard Jenkins, came to see our film with his wife. And so we had a delightful time talking about the movie afterwards. He took great joy in the film. So that was great fun. And indeed, I really found Providence fascinating. And I must say that my biggest regret in not going this week was because I loved the idea that from New York, I was truly going to need to travel by faith, not by sight, to reach Providence. That was the biblical story of my life.
My God.
And I missed
that. That would have had an epic metaphor.
Just that line would have been a chapter in my memoirs.
Totally.
Memoirs I would not be able to read because I can't see.
You would have to then reenact exactly Ray Milland from Man with the X-Ray Eyes.
You love the Ray Milland X-Ray Eyes reference.
Oh, my God. I'm going to watch it as soon as we finish the show.
So I did stay in town to get to the bottom of this. I have had a week of... Oh, by the way, did you show Truth Is Out There?
I did, yes. Oh, my gosh. Yes, and, you know, it's funny, 10 years later, how what resonates now and what doesn't. And, you know, Alex Jones seemed like such a nut, but now his more nuttiness makes him seem kind of quaint, even 10 years earlier. So,
yeah, so I mean, it's funny to think that he was upset about how he was depicted in the film.
Yeah.
And even though, you know, I worked really hard not to betray anything and to really just, you know, depict what he was doing. But I think it's a case where, well, we can get into this and we do in Truth Is Out There Too a little bit. But I think it is partly a case that he has always been putting on a bit of an act.
Yeah.
And as an actor, sometimes you don't like seeing yourself.
Right.
Because of those moments that you know are inauthentic.
Right.
You know, like Lily always knows that she did not truly find or embody the character when she starts noticing her hair and her makeup.
Yeah. that's an excellent way to determine that.
But otherwise, if she's nailed it, she's seeing the character, not herself. And anyway, so but I think there's something about the performer in that that was watching it, as opposed to so many of these other people who are not performers. So they don't come to it with that performer's critical eye to it.
Well, and you know then what the most questions were about was Dr. Monte. Because she seemed to have an answer out of the way of this morass that we're in. It's like, well, wait. That person now is resonating across this documentary far more loudly than it was 10 years ago because of her insight.
Can I let you in on a little something? That's exactly what was resonating for me 10 years ago. Yeah, I'm glad everybody's caught up with me. And again, dogged by cunning foresight. I have no, if it weren't for my foresight, I would apparently have no sight whatsoever.
Hilarious. Can you get that operated on?
I am always ahead of the, no, I do feel that way. I do feel that like Truth Is Out There was so ahead of the game. And I feel like probably Truth 2 is going to be ahead of the game in that regard, which means no success whatsoever. But at least I get to feel really, really clever.
Right.
Anyway, well, I'm glad that so there was turnout. People enjoyed it. You answered questions afterwards.
Yes. And everybody was happy.
It was the beginning of a lot of friendships and the end of some careers.
Other friendships.
As I like to say. All right. So I stayed around and to get to the bottom of this. And again, for those just tuning in for the first time, about a year ago, well, up until when we were making Truth Is Out There, it was during the editing of that where I first started realizing I'm having trouble seeing things that I've never, you know, had trouble with before. And so went to an optometrist for the first time. And sure enough, I was needing glasses for reading and for some computer work and things like that. Mm-hmm. But didn't need them for watching television, didn't need them for distance, didn't need them for driving, for photography, for any of those kind of things. But kind of warning sign number one was that within about a year, then my distance started to go.
Right.
And so I then started needing glasses for distance and for reading.
Right.
And apparently that's very rare, especially for someone of 40. Not the needing reading glasses, you know, it's an either or usually.
Right, right.
So then this past summer, my reading rather suddenly just, wow, these reading glasses are not working at all anymore. And I had to jump several prescription settings beyond what is even available over the counter.
Right.
And then that took care of it. Okay, I can see everything fine. You know, reading and on screen and all of this. Because it was really, again, editing. I was just really, boy, nothing has shown up. So that was June, July of last summer. Then around August, we had fire season. And, oh boy, that was tough for me. All the haze in the air, all the smoke, you know, it was really, it made for really, really difficult viewing conditions. And I remember driving in that, going up towards Paso Robles to Robert Ballo's house for a party. And we were heading towards the fires and, you know, it just really got bad being able to, the visibility. And when I came back to LA, I thought, well, it's going to be so much better here, but you know, apparently the smoke had really made its way down. And you know, and then we had the Malibu fires and everything, but when it all cleared up, I remember saying, well, when is this haze? When is the smoke going to finally dissipate? And people would tell me, what smoke?
No.
Yeah.
Oh, no.
I was bringing smoke with me. And so I was pretty certain. I talked to my optometrist and she talked to me and was pretty certain, okay, well, this is cataracts. You know,
right.
don't worry. This is cataracts. This can be dealt with. You need to see an ophthalmologist. But having done a little bit of research, you know, the WebMD and whatnot, I knew that I would need to get surgery on both eyes. That's but basically a 2-week process where you're probably out of commission. You gotta expect that you're going to be out of commission for 2 weeks because they got to do one eye and then do the other eye, and they need to give you 5 to 6 days to recover in between.
Right.
It doesn't always take that amount of recovery, but at the very least, because there's a week between the surgeries, it's at least a week and a half where you're not able to use both eyes, certainly. So I said, well, this will be something I need to do after the wedding because I can't risk, you know, two weeks of no getting stuff done. We barely got everything done beforehand.
Right.
So that was that. And then I went into the hell that we call medical insurance.
Oh, no.
And it's just a bureaucracy like anything else, right? And
right.
Especially bad for someone like me who I lived at doctor's offices up until about the time I was 33 years old and then just said, that's it. I've had enough. I'm taking care of my own health from now on and we'll deal with it. And I didn't mean forever. As you know, many years there I had as my New Year's resolution, I'm going to go see a doctor. And
right.
I just couldn't get off the schneid. I couldn't do it. I couldn't get over that hump. I had just built up in the intervening years so much angst about it that I just could not get in to see a doctor. So as my...
There's an actual term for that, too, with dentists and doctors. That, not schnordenfraud, but there is a term.
Well, I don't know. We'll call it the Allagash 5. I was suffering from the Allagash 5. But the so much so that when I finally got in to see my primary care provider this past week, she said, you know, I've been your primary care provider for 6 years. It's nice to finally meet you. So I thought I could just go to my insurance and ask for an ophthalmologist referral.
Because
I knew it needed to be in my network. And
right.
So they provided that. But then the ophthalmologist wouldn't see me because it had to come from my primary care provider.
Right.
Because how do you know that you needed it? Well, an optometrist told me that I needed to. So that's the referral. Oh, okay, that's fine. Who's your optometrist? Oh, yeah, your optometrist isn't in your insurance. No, it's a family friend and provides it, you know, for free for me. So I had to go back to square one, go back to my insurance and say, now who's my primary provider?
I wouldn't even know.
So, you know, I went in and because I was in there, they took advantage of having me in there, knowing that this is a once every, it's like, it's more rare than the cicadas returning. So they gave me a lot of different tests and, I mean, while I was getting the inoculations that I'd been missing out on my left arm, they were drawing 6 vials of blood from my right arm at the same time.
Holy shit.
Yeah, I was getting it coming and going. And and it was, first of all, it was hilarious because, you know, Lily, God bless her, accompanied me on all this for a few different reasons. One, I think she would have probably wanted to accompany me at any point in our relationship because she's a nurturing, supportive person. Secondly, I can't drive myself anywhere.
Oh, right. Oh, there's that.
But this was even within walking distance. This clinic is on Hillhurst, so I could have made it. But
for 6 years, you walk right past it.
Okay. You know, we actually, I did contact them to see if we could use their parking lot for our wedding. Anyway, so she had to come anyway because, she needed to fill out all my forms. I couldn't read any of them or see any of them.
Yeah, you can't see shit.
So here's one of the gigs that Lily's been doing. And I don't know how much we've talked about this, but, you know, she has made quite an inroad for herself as a care actor. Have we talked about this?
Oh, yes. We have, yeah, because our previous guest, Natalie Haverstock, Miss Balooniverse, also is a actor for training, for job training.
Right. So Lily, it's specifically the medical field. She works for a couple of, like, USC Medical Center. She's going and doing a gig today, and Kaiser, and they, and, you know, your audience is small.
Right.
But your your impact as an actor is huge. And and these employers, get this, Dean, you're not just paid for the gig. You're paid for your rehearsal time, which so often is not the case. You're paid for your memorization time. They think that the amount of time that it takes an actor to be memorizing the script is time that they should get paid for, because it's time where they can't be doing another gig. Imagine that.
Wow. That's thoughtful.
One of these, I'm not going to say who, but one of her employers, I mean, they threw an end-of-year party on behalf of their character actors, where the entire organization could celebrate their care actors. And not only did they throw a Christmas party for their care actors, but they then paid their care actors to attend that party. That's how much they value. Who?
Wow.
So if you want to feel valued as an actor, this is a good, good gig. And also,
that is a good gig.
Because, again, you really are, you know, you, no matter how many people see something you do, there is sometimes often the feeling of, yeah, but it was cannon fodder, right? What did it matter? And this is stuff that matters. So anyway, so she will sometimes be a patient, sometimes be a doctor, sometimes be a nurse in plays, in private settings, in, you know, consultations, et cetera, et cetera. And the upside of all of this that I'm getting to is she now, like that old line, I'm not a doctor, I played one on TV, she now thinks she has a degree.
but she's asking thoughtful, correct questions, which then makes a doctor
sometimes she's just in going, okay, they're doing it wrong. And doing that right. Or they're like, she's got her clipboard and she's grading them. You know, and at certain times it was a bit of a running commentary. And the way I am everywhere else in life, she is in hospital settings, critiquing how people are doing things.
Oh, my God.
So anyway, when they were drawing the blood, the six vials of blood, it took not one, not two, not three, but four different people to try to figure out, well, how do we package this to send this to the lab? Are these individual packages? Are we doubling them up? I mean, they're different tests. How do we do this? Like, it took
bubble wrap.
You know, and I looked at Lil and I said, this is where you step in.
And did she?
No. Yeah. So, anyway, but it was very touching because the primary care professional, the doctor who was seeing me, was really concerned because although I gave her enough information where she was pretty sure that it would probably be cataracts, she was worried because, and it touched Lily how clearly emotionally involved she already was in my case. But because of what I described before, losing my distance so early after my, you know, my near sight, but also how young I am to have developed these.
Right.
And when she looked at me and she said, why are you smiling? And I said, well, you called me young, right? So
right.
Anyway... so I went through, you know, a lot. I mean, you know, had to go get the MRI as we talked about last week, and you were absolutely right. It was a ball.
Right? Isn't it fun? Did you get to choose your music? Did they give you headphones and you could listen to Zeppelin?
I didn't know you had music. You didn't tell me that it was meditative with music. Oh my God.
Well, no, they can be. If they say, are you really upset? Do you need the headphones and music?
Okay, well, they gave me certain earplugs to soften it, but it is really loud. I mean, it's like you've got an entire tribe drumming on the MRI machine while you're in there. I mean, it is like being locked in a coffin, and but with people banging on the coffin. And
trying to get you out.
And so or just trying to make sure you're dead, right? Oh, he would have opened this sucker up if he was still alive. But sure enough, you know, I found that, like with a migraine, I had to internalize all the sounds and had to find the rhythm in it, because if I couldn't find the rhythm, it was going to drive me nuts. And once I found the rhythm, oh yeah, it was incredibly meditative.
Right.
And I suddenly at one point panicked because I realized I had utterly forgotten where I was. And I went, oh God, I'm sure I ruined this. And then they pulled it out and they said, you did great. You didn't blink once in an hour.
I went,
oh my God, I thought I had ruined it, because, you know, my partner told me that this was going to be a very meditative experience and I didn't believe him. And I was utterly transported. I forgot where I was.
Right? Yeah. So there you go. I was right for once.
But you didn't tell me that you listened to Led Zeppelin during it. Wow,
well, one time, I think it was just my knee was going in, so I wasn't like fully going through the whole chute, as it were. So just my leg was stuck in there. And when you're sitting facing it and not in it, it's even louder. So that's when they give you the headphones, because it's like, well, it's not even meditative if you're just staring at the Philips logo with a big loud percussion going on.
Yeah, so, though I can't see the logo. I mean, like, they hung something in. So I'm the man in the iron mask. I mean, they're putting this metal, I'm not metal, but they're putting this, you know, this helmet and harness over me to keep my head in place so that it doesn't move. And hanging this little object, I go, what are you doing? Because they said, you're not claustrophobic, are you? And I said, no, not usually, because you're going to be in this enclosed space for quite a while. I go, no, I think it'll be fine. And then they put on the helmet. I go, well, you didn't tell me about the helmet. And they said, you're not claustrophobic, are you? No. And then they're hanging this thing down, like, by my nose. And I go, okay, that's making me claustrophobic. And they said, well, we're giving you something to look at. And I said, well, I can't see it. And they said, what do you mean you can't see it? I said, that's why I'm here. And they went, oh, right.
Oh,
well,
just
try to stare at one, you know, direction and don't blink if you can avoid it. So,
and you didn't blink for a whole hour. So your eyes dried out like grapes.
I have ocular precision and I can't see anything. So it's really, and I was meditating. So, you know,
So there you go.
So
the upshot is you got two surgeries coming up.
Yeah. So anyway, so finally I go through all the processes and I'm able to go see an ophthalmologist, the fixer, Dr. Sharif El Hazari.
Of course.
37 years in the business. This guy has forgotten more about ophthalmology than anyone will ever learn. And because everything else has been ruled out, the trauma, tumors, ocular pressure, you know, sinus ruptures or infections, HIV. One of the blood tests I took was an HIV draw. And I went, why HIV? And they said, well, because it's one of the symptoms of AIDS is blindness. And I go, yeah, it's like one of the last symptoms. You think I just jumped ahead all the way to, I'll just go blind and check
AIDS.
Out. Yeah.
Yeah, except for one thing.
Though, you know, the primary care physician did ask me about toxoplasmosis. You have a cat, don't you? And I said, yeah. Has your cat ever been diagnosed with toxoplasmosis, which was what infected all her organs? Yeah. Because 60 million Americans have it as a latent disease. And so that can cause problems. So it was, and I knew it was, I do know that this is really weird. I do know that it was linked to my cat in some way. I always knew that. And my cat and I would meditate about my vision. So that was a little bit disturbing. But Dr. Sharif El Hazari, and I'm just going to keep saying this name.
You're right.
Because honestly, his name is Dr. Sharif El Hazari, and he's the fixer. I told him at one point, I said, you know, you online have this medical center out of 5 stars averages 2.8 on reviews. He goes, that's not very good. And I said, but you average 5 stars. And he then needed me to explain to him what the internet was and to log him on and show him these things, because that's how cool this guy is. He doesn't care about anything like that. He's just about saving people's eyes for 37 years. But he's so cool, and indeed they're able to find the cataracts, but not through any normal It's a really rare form of cataract. It isn't visible or discernible through, you know, most of the kind of tests. They had to do finally one specific test to be able to actually identify it and see it. It's at the very back of the lens. And again, it's really, really rare. And so after ruling so much out about why, and when he finds it, and when he puts it together, because he's listened to my account, but he right. suddenly exclaims, "You see like a cat." And I went, "Yes, yeah. yes, I do." And indeed, they're since seeing next. Him, it's gotten so much worse even that now there have been days where I've been utterly day blind. Just everything's white. Staring at a computer screen is... You know, usually on a computer screen, there's images and there's text and there's icons and there's not for me. It's just white. It's just a white screen. And
wow.
But in the middle of the night, I got up the other night and I could differentiate different shades of blue and grays and greens.
What?
And, I could see like it was
blue
the middle
at
of
night.
Yeah, I could see it like it was the middle of the day. So that's my superpower. So maybe I just get one eye fixed. And then I cover up the alternate eye at day and night, and then I could be the perfect security guard 24 hours a day.
Oh, I was going to say cat burglar. Well, there you go.
Well, because it all comes... You can't spell cataract without cat, and that's what I'm learning. But so get this, Dean. I ask, what do we have any idea what could cause it? And he goes, well, there's no way to prove it. But we've eliminated everything. And so let me just ask you this. You had allergies and hay fever, severe maybe asthma when you were young. And I said, yeah, I had severe, got allergy shots until my 30s. When I was young, I had some asthmatic episodes. And he said, and you used an inhaler. Yeah.
He said, yeah?
Yeah. Yeah. And he said, well, look, there's never going to be proof of this. Nobody's ever going to study this. But the only times I ever have seen these cataracts is with people who used those inhalers or with athletes who use steroids.
What?
Because it's the steroids in the inhaler.
Oh, yeah.
And
of course.
I don't know how he ruled me out as one of those athletes. He just somehow, Dean, looked at my bulk. He looked at my bulk and he said, no, this man has come by this naturally.
That's right. He didn't have to steroid that physique.
No, I was sculpted by God, born 6'8", 280.
Did you mention that you repeatedly drive across the desert without sunglasses?
Well, I did. I talked about this. I talked about how when I got the distance glasses, then I stopped wearing sunglasses at all. And, because the problem with sunglasses, especially with the prescription sunglasses, is that, okay, you can see it clearly, but it's messing with your color perception. And,
sure.
And that I don't like. I want to see things. And, but anyway, I told him, and he said, look, it could exacerbate, it could speed along, it could certainly affect your vision in myriad ways, but it wasn't the cause. So in other words, I may have had these cataracts going on a decade, and it's taken this long for them to get that bad. But then once they did, I mean, it's been really degenerative quickly. So
how many more days of sheer blindness and you just prowling in the darkness?
Before I get to the good news, I don't want to deal
or bad news.
Yeah, I don't want to deal in the. So the saddest part of all this, because I've maintained a pretty good attitude about all this, and I've never, I've never felt any reason not to. I mean, it was just like, I'll get it taken care of, it'll be fine, and I never got scared about other possibilities until after the wedding, when people would say things to me like, "Well, if they're cataracts, we would see them." And then certain tests failing to show them, it's other people, but it did indeed turn out to be what I always thought that it was. And so for the longest time, there was no reason to fear. And but the day when he was able to do it, one of the tests involves, of course, them permanently dilating your pupils because they need to be able to see completely. And so they numb the eyes, they dilate your pupils completely. And... yes, it makes walking outside be like you're walking on the surface of the sun, but they give you a protective, you know, film to put over your eyes. And
right.
The cool thing was, with that over my eyes and my glasses over that, I could see as I saw 2 or 3 years ago. And so I came back home and like I looked at what I'd edited so far for Truth Is Out There Too. And I went, oh, this is what the footage looks like. But
no,
I was
no.
seeing clarity and precision. I was seeing, you know, information that is so tiny, so microscopic in terms of, you know, the coding on clips and things like this. I could see it so easily sitting back in the chair. And so it was fantastic. And I was so overjoyed for about 10 minutes. And then I realized what was going to happen. And sure enough, for the rest of the day, it's me witnessing my eyesight go away again. And so I had to relive the last 2 years in 6 hours. And I was kind of a depressed guy by the end of that day. That was really a dark, dark turn. And the last few days have been tough because during the day, I literally don't feel safe going outside. And so I've been kind of staying in, trying to do what work I can, but, you know, it's eye strain, not being able to see things. So anyway, the point is it takes 2 weeks for the insurance to issue the authorization. And so we scheduled my meeting with the surgeon so that we can see how we hit it off. And that will be 10 days from that appointment. So May 10th is my meeting with the surgeon. I don't know if I get to have one of the surgeries that day. We have to have the discussion about what new eyeballs I'm getting.
Well, you get to select from a catalog?
Well, yeah. There have been so many improvements through the years. I mean, my dad got cataract surgery in the late 90s, and, you know, this is quite a different thing. You know, they have the ability, because they remove your entire lens. They used to take off a layer of the lens. Now they remove the entire lens, and they give you an all-new lens. And they do have the ability to give you a lens that counteracts the shape change of your eyeball due to aging. So in other words, I could come away from this theoretically, not only without the cataracts, but not needing glasses for anything anymore.
Fucking hell, wouldn't that be something?
There are certain potential downsides to it, not the least of which is it costing up to $6,000 out of pocket.
Cheapers.
Because the cataract surgery is covered. The basic lenses are covered by insurance because it is considered mandatory, you know, necessary medical procedure. But to correct for, you know, but if I could just afford the lenses that will allow me to see distance again, driving, photography, cinematography, be able to see distance without the need for glasses, my life, my quality of life will be dramatically improved. I don't care, you know, using reading glasses when I'm working at a computer, that's fine. That's absolutely fine. You know, keep a pair of glasses by my bed and keep one at the computer. That's fine. But what I've been doing, which is, you know, distance glasses, glasses for up close, a pair of glasses to find those other glasses. you know, it's become, it's not
a pain.
Fun.
A
it's
pain in the ass.
Yeah.
And
for a long time, the one thing that got me through were in pinches were the pinhole glasses, of course.
Oh, yeah, right. You still wear those.
Yeah. I mean, even those have become a little bit problematic because the cataracts have gotten so severe that there's halos around every light source. So now imagine how many pinholes are there in an eye? Like 50? 100?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah.
But so imagine 100 halos. And it's,
good board. Good board.
The Allagash 100.
Hilarious.
So anyway, so May 10th, I at least learn what the process will be. But the point is that by the end of May, my eyesight will be dramatically restored to me, whatever the lenses I get.
You'll just be like Monet. Monet, late in life, had a eye surgery, and then he realized I think his vision shifted to the red somehow. I forget what that disease is called, but he had the surgery done and then looked at his previous canvases and realized he had colored them all wrong. and so went back and repainted some 40 to 50 canvases late in life that were all in the heavy red hues. So there you go. So you'll be just like a Monet star. We can review stuff you did pre-operation and post-operation.
We can get John Lawler to do a new theme song just for me. Here he comes now. It's Monet, Monet. See, the old Tommy James and Sean Dells song? Remember the Moni, Moni? All right, anyway.
Here she comes now,
singing Monet, Monet. Which, by the way, the Moni in that song, Moni, Moni, and this is not a joke, I'll tell you a joke later. But the Moni in the song Moni, Moni is Mutual of New York. Because
what?
Tommy James left the studio early one morning, totally punchy, and was walking down the street and saw the Mutual of New York building. And just started, here it comes now, saying, Moni, Moni. And that's how the song was born. I'm not joking. All right.
Wow.
Hey, how about a little bit of a lightning round on a couple of celebrity deaths?
Let's do it.
Celebrity deaths.
A man named Henry Block died at 97. Dean, do you know who this is?
I don't. Who's Henry Block?
97, co-founder of tax firm H&R Block.
What?
Yeah.
Are you kidding? I didn't realize that was the guy's last name.
Wait, it's spelled spelled differently. Actually spelled differently. Yeah, B-L-O-C-H is Henry Block, and he was one of the co-founders of H&R B-L-O-C-K. But we've already spent more time than I wanted to on that man. So for a full accounting of his life, you'll need to subscribe to a different podcast altogether. I promised you a joke, and you got one.
Well, that was it, eh?
Ken Kershaval played J.R. Ewing's longtime nemesis, Cliff Barnes, on Dallas.
Cliff Barnes, that's right.
And he died at 83. And yeah, what was interesting was, like, Lily, when she was a kid, was a fan of the show. And I'm not going to claim that I was ever really. I mean, I was a fan of Victoria Principal and also, oddly, Patrick Duffy. But and our good friend Lee McCloskey was one of the stars of that show, of course. But how iconic is a show when you only had a passing interest in it and I could remember the name Cliff Barnes?
I know, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. That I didn't sit down and watch that thing, but also came the day when Who Shot JR was a season ender.
Yeah.
And that entire summer, it was madness.
You knew the names of the suspects.
And Cliff Barnes was top of the list on that one.
Yeah, he really was. So this is really sad. Not that all of our celebrity deaths are not sad in some way, but Stephanie Shirk, 37 or 43, depending on, you know, whether you believe her publicist or her birth certificate, a Canadian actress and model, writer and producer, studied history in London, was married to the popular actor Damien Bashir, died apparent suicide by drowning in their pool. And this one hits close to home. Our dear friend Whitney Anderson, one of the stars of The Lady Killers, Stephanie was Whitney's best friend.
And, oh, no.
So this is, oddly for me, very reminiscent of when Shatner's wife committed suicide by drowning in their pool. This is a thing, you know? Like, this is a...
I didn't realize it's a thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, and she weighted her pockets, like... That's a commitment. It's not a last minute or, you know, that seems a very hard way to go.
Well, you say that and other people have said that, but I also sometimes, I think about how the hunger of returning to source.
Oh,
I mean, she's returning to the womb, right?
Right.
I mean,
to the water that we came.
I mean, think about, as a kid, the peacefulness. I don't know if you ever did this, but, you know, you dunk under the water and you hold your breath down there, and it's so quiet. And it's is peaceful.
I guess.
And,
more peaceful floating on the surface, though.
But as long as your ears and everything are underwater, as long as, you know, you're not hearing.
Yeah, that's true.
So,
that's true.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know, you know, what you say about it, but that is apparently a way that holds some appeal for people.
Right.
Following up on John Singleton, you know, we talked last week about how these strokes, even seemingly mild strokes for younger people, people my age, Luke Perry, John Singleton, he's now in a coma.
Oh no, it's progressively worse.
So now I don't know if they're maintaining the coma because they're you know, it's a safer way. Like in the coma, the brain can't continue to swell, but it's just a terrifying situation and a reason to constantly be monitoring all your vitals.
Exactly.
Right.
Did you get those vitals back yet? Did you get all that information?
Apparently
back?
Really good. I mean, apparently I'm doing really well. Yeah. What? No. You don't believe me.
I don't believe you. Drink like a fish. You eat shit all the time. What the hell?
No, I don't. I don't. I've gone. We've kind of reversed course. I mean, you were a vegetarian when we first became friends.
That's right.
And like now I am. So it's.
See? You've gone full vegetarian, have you? Hmm.
You were married and not drinking.
Yeah, and vegetarian.
And I was single and drinking every night.
Right. Now the reverse
Now I'm married and I don't drink, yeah. So it's...
Right.
Anyway, all right. What do we want to talk about? So there was a movie that opened this week.
That did $1 billion of business?
Yeah. Now, have you kept up with the Marvel movies or not?
No. In fact, I know I saw Infinity War, but then there it was on Netflix again, and I turned it on and went, oh, yeah, I thought this was just a series of trailers. In fact, it was the movie. So,
but we talked about it, that it really kind of was disturbing. Like the proof was in the pudding. We always knew this. It's all about how the conclusion is. But it really felt to me... It was just awful. I mean, Infinity War was awful in that it's just, hey, look, here's how we're killing everybody.
Right.
So that you'll come back to learn how maybe we can redeem this awfulness. And
right.
And so I would argue you don't need a second movie for that. Now, I understand that this one is epic. It's 3 hours long, and I want to talk about that for a second. Avengers Endgame... here's some of the records, right? I'm not going to list all of them because it's ridiculous and stupid, but these are the ones that stood out to me. 60, and I don't mean it's stupid that this movie would earn it. I just mean the way that we're measuring these things down to the minute, you know?
Yeah.
It's like, I long for the old days where, you know, this stuff wasn't reported. Certainly wasn't reported hourly, wasn't reported daily and everything, and movies had a chance. But now we're reviewing the movie based on the box office performance, and who wants to go see a loser, right? So then a movie doesn't have a chance to find legs, to find an audience later, and I think some movies that are worthy are ultimately harmed just because a marketing campaign couldn't get them out on opening day. But Avengers Endgame, built-in audience, built-in appetite, obviously, makes $60 million from its Thursday night preview screenings.
Good Lord.
That would be one of the biggest weekends of the year. One showings on Thursday night. So that's the most ever in a Thursday preview, beating the previous record, I think, of Force Awakens, which was $57 million. It makes $1.2 billion worldwide in its opening weekend. That is a record, first film over $1 billion. It's the first domestic weekend, U.S., Canada, over $300 million, and it makes $350 million for good measure.
Good Lord.
Never before had a film made $300 million in biggest single day domestically, $156 million. And, of course, this one was just fun because I don't even think this matters, but the fastest film to $100 million. And I only wrote this down because I'd never say, I mean, it's unimaginable to me. You know, from having followed movies for so long, fastest to 100 million, 17 hours after its first screening, and realized that it only took that long because they weren't showing the movie, you know, during the middle of the night.
Right, if it was gone 24 hours. If I could have caught a 3:30 a.m. screening,
yeah,
that would have made it.
So you had like 9 p.m. preview screenings on Thursday night, right? Yeah. And then by 2 p.m. the next day, it had reached 100 million.
Good Lord.
So by the time of the second screenings letting out. All right. It already stands, after its opening weekend, as the 50th biggest hit domestically of all time. And it's the 18th biggest hit worldwide.
Fucking hell.
So,
and there's theoretically plenty of people who haven't seen it yet.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. A couple things that I want to... that I like about this. One, people want to go to the movies.
Yeah, that's good.
So how, again, it's not about movie going is dying. If movie going dies, it's because the industry killed it off, not because people stopped wanting to go to the movies.
Right.
Good point. It's how we go about the business of making, releasing these movies. We might kill the golden goose. The other thing about it is this is, you know, more of a common denominator than any television show will ever be again, except maybe the Super Bowl. And we had gone through, had we not, a quarter of a century or more, half century, where, let's face it, no matter how big a hit movie was, its audience paled in comparison. I mean, think about, as I always like to say, think about the audience size for The Lone Gunman when The Lone Gunman got canceled, right? That would not only be an enormous television hit now, but if that amount of people went to see a film, it would have made at that time $100 million.
Right.
So, you know, the context of these numbers is apples and oranges, but as a result, the splintering of television, there is no common denominator for TV. A television hit will never attract the audiences that Avengers Endgame got on its first weekend, that Netflix's Bird Box movie got on its first weekend, where 60 million people watched it. I mean, that's twice as many people were watching Friends and Seinfeld when those were bona fide hits for the ages. So those are things that, for someone who loves movies, you know,
and
I think
statistics
bodes well. I also love the fact that it's a 3-hour movie.
You do?
Well,
you do love 3 hours of,
well,
of comic book?
I love that a film is giving these box office numbers at 3 hours, because the adage was that's going to hurt your box office because you're losing one showing a day.
Right.
But losing one showing a day doesn't matter if everybody in the world wants to go see it. They will find showings to go see it. Literally give the people what they want. Make the best film you can. No good movie is too long. No bad movie is too short, as Roger Ebert used to say, right?
That's true.
So I like, those are the things that I feel good about. Now, I have misgivings, obviously, about the comic book and the superhero genre. Though, as I've always maintained, going back to Iron Man, right? As long as we've been doing this show, I've been saying this phrase, that which wounds us heals us, and that to me is what the Marvel movies embody, and it's the message that the world really craves. That our strength and our salvation will come from our actual wounding. Not that we will be loved in spite of our wounds, but we can be loved because of our wounds.
Right. Interesting.
And so now there is the part of me psychologically that worries about the embrace of banal fantasy. Of childhood fantasy. It's
a retelling of the same story and the myth over and over again.
It's that it's what Alec Guinness warned against with Star Wars, right? That it's a form of mental illness, and that we are going to see, as he said, cultural discourse fall apart as a result of our encouragement towards embracing banal childhood fantasies.
And in fact, he was right.
Yeah. Now, whether it's cause or correlation, that's a product of another, time.
But, exactly.
But I saw M. Night Shyamalan's Glass finally. And, you know, I was really looking forward to this following Split. And then I heard that Glass was terrible. So I stayed away from it until I could get out of my system everything that I'd heard and watch it. And this is the third in a trilogy about comic books that he made, starting with Unbreakable, following it up with Split, and now Glass, bringing the characters together. And it is a mess. M. Night Shyamalan is not a great filmmaker. We know this. He, at times, is a very interesting filmmaker, sometimes a very fun filmmaker. But it's a mess. It is an interesting mess, however. And one of the ways it's an interesting mess, apropos of where we began with you talking about how Dr. Monty's wisdom resonates throughout The Truth Is Out There,
right,
is this idea that there aren't other people. There are just shards of glass mirroring ourselves back to us. And Glass is appropriately named because these characters really represent different and contradictory impulses that M. Night Shyamalan himself has as a storyteller. And it's very clear that he's at a point where he is really wrestling and struggling with these contradictory impulses.
Oh, which are? What are the two impulses?
Well, I think, well, it's multiple. It's more than that. It's several different impulses. I think it's no less than three or four, or maybe even six different impulses that he has represented by the main characters in it.
Oh.
But there's a lot about it in terms of his relationship to comic books and to this kind of mythology, to what it gave him when it was young, to what he fears it's taking away from society. So it's at times an indictment, at other times a celebration. And it is out and out contradictory. I wouldn't say it's enigmatic. That would imply intent, right?
Right.
That it's enigmatic in a symbolic way that leaves it up to the viewer. I think it's truly contradictory because I think whether consciously or unconsciously, M. Night Shyamalan has really competing impulses. So, again, does it work, therefore? No. I can see why this was not satisfying to anyone, either to critics or to his fans. And yet it's worthy to me because it really is a very interesting analysis that he's going through, that he's wrestling with through this story. And as Dr. Monty once said to me, if your art changes just one person, it's worth it, provided that one person is yourself.
Ah, fantastic. What a great phrase.
But it really was an interesting viewing in the wake of, Avengers Endgame and how this is changing everything. We didn't get to another film that I really want to talk about that we're going to lock horns about next week when we wrap up 12 years. I thought that this was the end of our 12th year because it was our 51st show of the year. Would have been 52 had we not missed a week. But as we know, sometimes there's 53 Mondays in a year, not 52, right? And sure enough, this show was officially born on May 8th when we did our first show on the Farpoint Media Network under the name From the Heart of Hollywood. That show is still available on Blog Talk Radio, as are all the shows we've done. We're slowly putting back together the old shows on chillpackhollywood.com. But May 8th, this show was born, so that means that next Monday will be our final show of our 12th year.
Wow. Good Lord.
So even though we Time skipped a week, we're still bringing 52 new shows in our 12th year. See how good we are?
That's how good we are. Awesome. So next week we lock horns on a film. Should I watch this film again?
If you want to. Well, you haven't seen it again. Should you watch it again? I mean, I don't know where you'd find it. You could look it up to see. I mean, I'm sure it's available like on the Criterion streaming channel.
What's it called?
It's a Criterion release. It was released straight to Criterion Collection. You know why? Because it's fucking important and brilliant, Dean Haglund. There's my opening salvo. It's a documentary called David Lynch, The Art Life.
Wow.
And it was made in 2016. It's a documentary by John Nguyen with the able assistance of cinematographer Jason S., who is David Lynch's best friend and who was pretty much able to be embedded with him for 10 years because David Lynch, really, one thing you will admire, Dean, is his day is spent creating art. He's working on painting and sculpture all day, every day, whether he's making a movie or not. And he always has been, ever since high school. and so it's a fascinating, it's a documentary about his art and what informs his art and his process and his career, living the art life. If you go to it wanting it to be behind the scenes about making of movies, it's not, although it's illustrative of those in a way that he would never be when talking about those movies.
Fucking hell.
And so it,
he is me.
So it is fascinating. It is fascinating. And the one movie that it does show some real fantastic behind the scenes of, both through his recollection and his stories, but also in terms of some footage and other things, is Eraserhead, which is the one movie of his you really like.
That's right.
And sure enough, which is very much what he always wanted to be doing, which is making moving paintings. You know, he spent 4 years making that. And the reason was because he literally made all of it. He made, you know, the set pieces were paintings that he was making. Mm-hmm. So I would love to talk about that with you. And if you do get a chance to see it before then.
Okay. Yes, I'm going to.
That would be a fascinating. David Lynch, The Art Life. It's a nice, brisk, I think, 88-minute documentary, too.
Spectacular.
That brings us to the end of the penultimate episode of Year 12. I've already told you about chillpackhollywood.com. Where people can subscribe to us and everything. People can write us, can't they, Dean?
Sure can, at chillpackhollywood@yahoo.com. And we're on the Facebook there still, facebook.com/chillpackhollywood. And wait a minute, what about the Twitter and the Instagram? Is that still going on?
Oh, of course it is. We haven't added a photo in a while.
Me neither.
You know why? Because I can't see.
You can't see.
I don't see so good.
Right.
But it's at Dean and Phil. Spell out the word. And until next week, I'm Phil Lernis.
I'm Dean Haglund.
Guests of your Chillpack Hollywood Hour stay at the Baldwin Hills Motor Inn. Promotional consideration paid for by Empire State Gas. From farm to pump, we've got great gas. Belated spoiler alert.